Welcome to the Sobriety Plus Group Saturday Night Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Phil, and I am an alcoholic. Group Conscious asks that you have 1 year of continuous sobriety to chair this meeting. And at this time, I'm going to read the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And with that, I'm going to take a minute to introduce our speaker tonight. Eric J. was, when I called him, he didn't hesitate to say he'd be willing to come over and speak tonight. He made a trip over from Titusville, Coco, and, you know, anybody that's willing to drive an hour to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous obviously wants to stay sober, you know. None of us have to do service work, but service work is how we tend to stay sober. And, you know, I met Eric, I think as a result of going either over to a meeting in Titusville or to the area assembly. I'm not sure which happened first. I know that at area assembly we got together with him and some other people and we had dinner. And it was a great experience. And I got to know Eric. And then through going over to the meetings over in Titusville, after the meeting we tend to get together and go have dinner. And, you know, that's a great thing about the fellowship. It's not just about waiting uncle and staying drunk, staying sober. It's about getting to know people, too, after the meetings and getting to become part of the fellowship and you know, to have a host of new friends. And I consider Eric one of those. And so without any further ado, Eric.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Eric, and I'm an alcoholic.
Yes.
And thank you for asking me over here. As I told you, just remember what goes around comes around. So that when I have an opportunity to call on a speaker, and I need a speaker at some point in time, just remember. You know, that's what we do here at Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I'm not picking on Phil, and Phil's not picking on me. We're giving each other an opportunity to further the carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what we are here for tonight, is to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And welcome to the newcomers. Was it Trey and Trish? Did they get those names right? My goodness. What an honor to be here, being able to talk to you as newcomers. When I went to my first couple AA meetings, I had no idea what was going on. I don't remember a thing that would happen there. Except that I went to a meeting someplace in time, you know, and I couldn't tell you what happened. And that's probably true for most of us when we first go to Alcoholics Anonymous, is that it's all strange. It's like, what did he say? And what are they talking about? And it doesn't come easy. And even after 20 years, sometimes it goes, what is he talking about? So it gets a little clearer after a while, but it takes a while to get clear. And the nice thing about it is we don't have to worry about, oh, I got to graduate on a certain day or something like that. But congratulations to the Eastside Club for 4 years. That's great. Yeah. So East, what was it? Sobriety Plus. Okay. But the Eastside Club group or something like that. Phil told me where how to come. You know, I'm driving down the road looking for this building and watching the addresses on all the buildings. And I said, okay, it's got to be on this side. And I drive back and I didn't see this building behind the retention pond, you see. I figured it was a trick that Phil was playing on me. See, and then I turned around over here in the little 7-Eleven over here, and I know they couldn't help me out any because I don't speak Spanish. So I finally found the place. So, but it's a neat little clubhouse, and then somebody told me it was a cat house at some point in time. Well, there's cats running around out there. So anyway, but good food, and thank you to David. I think he did all the cooking. Wonderful.
Some of it,
yeah. Yeah. But what I'm supposed to do here tonight is to tell you a couple things, and that is what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, and to pass on to you and share with you some of my experiences and some of my hope and some of my faith in Alcoholics Anonymous, what it was like for me. And I told Phil when we were talking about this the other day, I said, well, I got invited to speak at the Cape Canaveral group last night. So I said, I don't know if that's going to be good for you guys, that I'm going to use up all the good stuff Friday night. You know, I won't have anything left over or Saturday night. I'll just stand up here and say, well, you wanted me to share for 3 minutes, so that's right. I'm done with 3 minutes. Or maybe it's, you know, it's a good warm-up or something like that. So, but they didn't throw any shoes at me last night or anything else like that, so I guess I was okay. I know I stayed sober for an hour, and we went out and had dinner afterwards, which is that meeting after the meeting that's so important to the fellowship. But about me and what's happened to me and what it was like for me. I start talking about my journey through Alcoholics Anonymous because that's what it is. It's a journey. It's not a destination or an end. It's just a journey. And every day can be a different trip and a different experience. But my journey started on August 27th, 1990. And that particular day was the day that I started this particular journey. And it was the day that I drove into the Circles of Care treatment facility over in Melbourne. That was a Monday morning. And, you know, I never forget that particular day because that's where it all started. And I've heard many, many times in here that if I forget what it was like, I'm bound to repeat it. And what I remember of those last days and those last weeks and those last months of my drinking, I don't ever want to repeat it. I never want to repeat all that stuff that went in before and that I did before August 27th. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me I don't have to do that. It tells me that if I follow the instructions in here, the simple rules that are in this book, I never have to drink again. And I believe that. And I believe that to be true for me. And that's really the big, big promise of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I can stay sober and live a happy, joyous life one day at a time if I follow these instructions. But on August 27th was the day that I came to, like I had been coming to for many days those last several months. The night before was not untypical because I had drunk myself into another blackout, and I was still driving and driving in a blackout. And I wound up going down to my girlfriend Joan's apartment down in Palm Bay, Florida, which is toward the south end of the county down there. This was related to me later on because they don't have a specific personal recollection of it. Now, obviously, in a drive-out, a blackout, you don't remember all this stuff. But she related to me later on that she had come down from the apartment because of all the blue lights out in the parking lot that attracted her attention. And what attracted her attention were the two cop cars surrounding my car, in which I was passed out, the doors were locked, the windows were up, and they were trying to get me out of the car or get my attention unsuccessfully. Somehow or other, this lady, Joan, managed to have the cops leave and not arrest me or you know, break into the car and take me away. She was a very forceful person. She also drank like me, which was wonderful to have a drinking buddy that drank like me and enjoyed doing some of the crazy stuff that I did when I was drunk. Anyway, that's how my Sunday evening was going, is the cops were trying to get me out of my car to obviously arrest me and take me off to the drunk tank. They didn't succeed, and she interceded and I'll go upstairs, and it's like, no big deal. Okay, fine, let's have some more drinks. You know, that was the way I was going. I didn't start out like a lot of people start out in an early age, hitting the bottle and becoming an alcoholic at an early age. Quite the opposite. My family, my mother and father, were not drinkers. My mother probably had a total of maybe 4 glasses of alcoholic beverages her entire life, which I thought was a little odd, but I didn't really think about it too much until I came into the program. My dad would get a 6-pack of beer, and it would last for months. You know, I see people shaking their head like, We were just talking beforehand, and it's true. I mean, he would have about a six-pack of beer from Melbourne to St. Cloud and have to stop and get a refill. That I understand, see? But I don't understand having a six-pack of beer sitting in the refrigerator for 6 months. Or a bottle of brandy my mother would buy my dad and would last him all year. I mean, I'd buy a fifth of the scotch and it wouldn't last me all day. I mean, that's the kind of drinking I understood. So I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. But there were things going on in the house that I didn't understand at the time, and I didn't understand for a long time. And what I finally found out years and years and years later was that while neither one of my mother or father were alcoholics, my grandfather was an alcoholic on my mother's side. And some of those traits passed down through my mother, and I was the recipient of some of those. And it was a little bit of that dysfunctional thing. And I figured it out later on, is that no matter how much I tried and no matter how much I succeeded, it never quite felt like enough. It was like there was some part of me still missing. In high school, for example, I was one of those horrible people who had straight A's and all that kind of good stuff and student council, but it never felt like I had really achieved what I needed to achieve. It was always not quite enough, and there was something always missing. The same in college. There was always something missing. Then I found out alcohol, and that helped. That took that part that was kind of missing and filled that blank in. And that worked for a long time. But it still, you know, it only worked for a little bit while the effect of alcohol was still in my system. And for many, many years, I was a nice functioning drinker, non-alcoholic, but drinker, and sometimes even more so. But as the years progressed, that need to fill in that blank and fill in that missing part, no matter how much I succeeded, no matter how big the house was or how fancy the cars were or how big the bank account was, there was always something quite not right in my life. And never quite enough. No matter how many things of success I could accumulate, it was never enough. But that alcohol seemed to fill in those blanks. And that's what I think I finally figured out years and years later in this program, and it's with the help of this program, was going on in my life for so many years. But the thing about alcohol, as I've discovered after I came in, is that as I drank more and more, and while I could control it for many, many years and able to escape most of the consequences, there came a time when that wasn't any true any longer. I hear people talk about what they lost because they drank. You know, I lost this, or I lost a wife, or I lost a house, or I lost a job. And I thought about that for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had a wife and didn't have a wife because of the drinking. And I had a house, and then I didn't have a house because of the drinking. And I had a job and a career, and I didn't have a job and a career. And I had a nice big fat bank account, and then I didn't have a nice big fat bank account because of the drinking. But I didn't lose those things. I didn't lose those things. You know, I was looking for my keys the other day, and I lost them. They were under a pile of papers. I lost the keys, but I found them. No, the job, the house, the son, all those things, I didn't lose them. What happened was alcohol became so important to me, so vital to me, that when it came down to making a choice, making a decision, or taking action to work on that particular problem or work on that relationship so that relationship could be salvaged or made healthy, the drink won out. I made a choice to drink rather than to do what was necessary to fix that relationship or work on that relationship. So I don't think I lost those things. It talks about in the book that alcohol is a rapacious creditor, and it would take and take and take, and I would willingly give it. And it to the point where, I would give my life for it, and that's the truth, because I tried to drink myself to death a couple of times. And about a month before I got sober, it got to that point where I got to that jumping off place, where life with alcohol was unbearable. Life without alcohol was inconceivable. Because where I was at that point in time is that chronic alcoholic that's described in our book, as described in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as so well defined by Dr. Silkworth in his writing, is that I had to have alcohol in my system to function, because if I didn't, if I came to in the morning and I couldn't get alcohol, the convulsions would start, the cramps and the throwing up and all that kind of stuff. And so on a daily basis, I had to go out and find alcohol and go to another liquor store and buy another bottle of something and try to get that down to stop the shakes, to stop the heaves, to stop the sweats and all the rest of the stuff that goes along with severe chronic alcohol and alcohol poisoning. And I was not slowly but fairly quickly killing my body because as I put more and more booze in my body, of course, it starts to eat away at you. I had gone to the family doctor a couple of years ago and before that, and he goes, "Your liver functions are a little bit off. You might want to think about maybe slowing down the drinking," you know. Because I wasn't telling him the truth about how much I would drink. You don't tell the doctor that, no. Okay, but he didn't tell me to stop, see. He just said slow down a little bit. So I thought, okay, you know, slow down is okay. I'll just drink a little bit slower. He didn't say stop. He didn't say I'd stop having a fifth or two fifths a day, just to drink slower. So I'm okay, I'll just sip instead of glug, you know. We have some twisted thinking on our. But I had gotten to that point where I just couldn't stand it any longer, and I had gotten also to the point where I realized that having fun and drinking had long since passed, that elusiveness that we chase so desperately to get rid of that when we're restless, irritable, and discontent, and we seek the comfort of alcohol that the alcohol instantly gives us, no longer did that for me. I know it's strange to think about it, but I couldn't get enough alcohol to get drunk. I mean, it just stopped working. I mean, yes, I would drink, and I would pass out, and I'd go into oblivion, but it got to the point where that's what I wanted. I didn't want to live any longer. I thought, you know, if I could just pass out and never wake up again, that would be wonderful. What a thought, just pass out and never wake up again. And so one night, I decided to do that, and I got a good stockpile of booze, and I started drinking it as heavily as I could, and I passed out. And I came to, I think it was about 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was on the kitchen floor of my house, and I thought, I'm dying. And then I decided I didn't want to die. We can't make our minds up. We don't drink, not drink, live, not live. What's going on here? So I called my brother and told him where I was at, and he came and got me to the hospital. And they said I had a 0.43 blood alcohol, which is hard to believe that a human being could still be alive with that much alcohol in their system. And they were kind of mystified, like, yeah. And so they stuck me on tubes and everything like that. And I spent about 4 days in the hospital, or 5 days. And I know the doctors came, the psychiatrists came, and counselors came and stuff like that. Because when you try to commit suicide, those kind of people come and visit you in the hospital. So I got out, and that was early August of 1990. And even though I had gone through that, and I knew, vaguely knew, that I was close to death and doing all that, what do you suppose I did? The nearest liquor store and crawled back in the bottle again. And that was in early August. 20 years ago, and I cannot tell you what I did between early August and August 27th of 1990. It was about a three-week period of my life. It's just gone. I have no real memory of it, except I know I was living in Satellite Beach, and that's about all I can tell you. Just gone, because it was just an alcoholic haze for the rest of that period of time until that particular morning. And on August 27th, I had never been to that place before. I didn't have a plan to get sober that day. I didn't have any court papers to require me to get sober or anything else like that. I didn't really know why I went there. I had another half a fifth of something in the car, And my typical morning would have been to finish that off and pass out and get another one and continue on the rest of the day. But that particular Monday morning, the car drove to Circles of Care. In earlier times, that car had autopilot and knew where every ABC liquor store was in town and could navigate to those liquor stores like on autopilot. Strange, but this one, it didn't go to the ABC. It went into this place, and the admissions director at the time was a guy by the name of Ken, who was a real card and one of us and a wonderful man. And he started asking me questions, and I had all these excuses and trying to debate with him what my rest of my life that day was going to be like. And I would say, well, you don't have a room. He says, we'll find a bed for you. I didn't want to hear that. Well, I don't have any clothes. Well, we'll take care of that. I didn't want to hear that. Well, I don't know about the insurance. He says, we'll take care of that. I didn't want to hear that. And I had these other things, arguments for me not staying there, and he had answers that I didn't want to hear for every single one of them. And then finally I said, okay, surprisingly to myself. As I look back, you know, that was my first small step of surrender to this disease, my first small step, and it was only a small step, to accepting something of a solution to my problems. See, up to that point in time, if I had a problem, it was I could fix it. I was in the job. My profession was fixing problems for other people, and I was very good at that until I became a chronic drunk, of course. But I could also fix problems for me until I became a chronic drunk, and then I couldn't fix problems for me. And that formula that worked so well for many, many years just didn't work. I kept trying to plug a number into it, and it didn't come out in the same way any longer. And I hadn't made the connection that alcohol and problems were connected, see. If my mind kept telling me if I have a problem, it's because you aren't doing what I want you to do, or they aren't doing what I want them to do. That was, and if I could just get you to do what I want you to do, then the problem would be solved. I didn't understand that alcohol was a big contributing factor to all these problems. See, I hadn't made that connection yet. It took me a while. And it's not that I'm a dumb person. I have a couple college degrees, but I was really, really stupid about that. It's amazing, you know. You don't have to have a college degree to figure this stuff out. I really don't. But even if you have one, it makes it difficult sometimes to have to figure it out. But I stayed in that facility for 28 days and started to learn about the disease and the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous and AA, but I really didn't understand any of it. And to those newcomers, you know, I didn't understand anything in the first 28 days. It was funny. Then I went next door to the, what is it, coffee bar or something like this over here to get a cup of coffee, and they asked me if I wanted a lid for my cup of coffee, and I said, no, I think I can handle it for a full cup of coffee without the lid. They gave us coffee in the treatment center, and I can tell you the first week they wouldn't give more than about a quarter of a cup because my hand was doing this for the first 2-3 weeks in there. Even on their good medicine, I was still doing this, and they realized that don't give one of those guys a full cup of coffee because it's going to wind up on the floor in their laps. It kind of set me back, and I remembered that a little bit. But I get out at 28 days, and I still hadn't figured out what had happened on that Monday morning to get me into that treatment facility. Because part of my story, and I'll get into it, is that I didn't have a God in my life. I didn't need one of those. Thank you very much. It's okay for you guys, but I don't need one. I can solve my own problems. I would consider myself, if somebody asked me, to be an atheist. I'd gone to church as a kid, but that was just fun to go to Sunday school and everything. I didn't believe in any of that stuff. So I didn't have a God, and I certainly didn't pray to him on that Monday morning to save me, because how can you pray to a God that you don't have any relationship or don't believe in, see? But they did talk about God in the treatment center, and that didn't work too well for me. We've all heard about, well, if you don't have one, you know, you use a doorknob, and that didn't make any sense to me either. So I kind of just rejected that out of hand, like, nah, that's crazy. But I get out on after 28 days, and I can tell you I was absolutely terrified. Because here I'm back out on the streets, undrunk for 28 days, no idea what to do, except I knew that something had happened in there for those weeks that I was in there. It was the first 28 days in my adult life that I hadn't had any alcohol in my system for probably 20 or 30 years. It's amazing to think that, but that was true. And things were feeling better. You know, you stop putting poison in your body, you do start to feel better. And I was fortunate to have a place to live and everything like that, but I didn't have a job. I was unemployable, but that really wasn't a big problem to me at that point in time. But they had told me to go to meetings, and they had taken us in the van to a couple of meetings in Melbourne, and one of them was a meeting place called Justice Pickles in downtown Melbourne, which was kind of a fun group and still is a kind of a fun group if you could find out where they're at, because they do tend to move around a lot. They have a history of that over the last number of years. But I started going there on a regular basis. But I still wasn't one of you, because I wasn't an alcoholic, because I didn't know what an alcoholic really was. And this book describes what an alcoholic is, as used and as applied in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I certainly didn't want to be like any of you, but that was where I needed to be. So I went to meetings. And since I could go to a lot of meetings, I went to noon meetings, and I went to 6 o'clock meetings, and I went to 8 o'clock meetings, and I went to the Village Inn meetings after the meetings, many times a week, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 times days a week I'd go to meetings, so I didn't have anything else to do. But things were still pretty much of a fog and a mystery to me. And in those early months, as we'd go around the room and introduce ourselves and do a little reading and stuff like that, I did say I was an alcoholic. But I was lying. Because I didn't believe that I was an alcoholic, because I didn't understand what an alcoholic was. And I've heard people talk about having a moment of clarity of what it really means to be an alcoholic. And it took me 13, 14 months of doing this. And I don't consider it to be white-knuckled sobriety or anything else like that. I figured that it just took that long, as dense as I was and as stubborn I was, to, you know, trying to still do it my way. I didn't drink or anything else like that. But it took me a while to finally get the message. And part of that was finally getting down to reading the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which when I finally got the idea that, okay, there's a book and I need to read that and everything like that. See, I love to read books. So you say, read the book. Here's the instruction manual. I go, great. Why didn't you tell me this at the beginning? Of course, they did, but, you know, it didn't sit in. I mean, I started out at age four reading books, 3 and 4 when I was young. Late in the night, my mother would have to come in and turn the lights off and take the book away from me. So I loved to read. So that wasn't the problem. It was just getting through the thick skull that this the solution was in here. But after about 13 or 14 months of this and finally reading some of this stuff in here, it finally dawned on me that, yes, indeed, I was an alcoholic, as described in this book. And not only that, but that the solution was in this book, and that if I just followed the instructions, these precise directions that are included in this book, that I too would have the sobriety and the recovery that the book promises. And I'll tell you exactly when it happened. It was at a noon meeting at Justice Pickles on Avenue C. And I think it was a Wednesday afternoon. And I had been going there for a long time. And the way the room was set up was you'd come in kind of the door and the speaker was over here, and I could sneak in and sit toward the back of the room and come in a little late and leave a little early and not be part of you. See, I was in the suicide row way back there. And that particular day, the only chair available was the one up front. And so that felt different, and it was different. And somebody said something, and it finally dawned on me, oh, my God. And I felt that's the moment I had my moment of clarity of being an alcoholic. And that wasn't a bad thing. It was a wonderful thing. So especially to the newcomers, I mean, if you're here for your first time or new to the program and you go, I don't know if I'm one of you guys and I certainly don't want you guys, trust me, it may take a while, but stick around. If you continue to come and if you continue to be part of instead of being on the outside, if you are one of us, if you are a chronic alcoholic, if you find out that if you take any amount of alcohol in your system, you can't control what happens next or how much you take or how often you drink, you're probably one of us, that you will hear the message that you hear at some point in time, and you'll have that moment of clarity. And I hope that happens for all of those who are still wondering about that. But I ran into this guy in early sobriety, Jim, who kind of became my sponsor. And he was one of these guys that had decades of such sobriety. You understand when you're 1 or 2 months sober and somebody has decades of sobriety, it's like, what? You know, 25 years? 35 years? What? It's inconceivable, no? That somebody would do that. It doesn't even compute. But this God thing that I mentioned earlier, see, I had a real problem with that because I had kind of also figured out that as I read this book, it tells me that not only do I have to be abstinent from alcohol, but that I had to have a spiritual solution, that I had to find something, whatever that I want to call that something. They talk about a higher power. They talk about God. They talk about light of the universe. They use a lot of different terms. So far, I found 26 different versions of spiritual entities that Bill writes and uses in the Big Book to describe God. So if you have trouble with the G-O-D word, there's 25 others in there that might work for you, including Czar of the Universe. If that one trips, does it for you, then go for it, you know. Light of the Universe and all these other kind of things. It's a fun little game I had played to figure out how many different versions of God that's in the Big Book. I needed at least a bunch of those to get me through those first months. But Jim, he didn't have that kind of problem with alcohol, with God, because he had figured it out. And as I went to Jim and I said, you know, I've got this relationship problem, or I got this business problem, or I got this financial problem, or I got this problem. His answer always was, and I was seeking, oh, do this and do that, because, you know, he had decades of sobriety. Trust in God. Oh, no, Jim. Look, she's doing this, and I need to know what to do. Now, trust in God. No. See, that didn't work. How can you trust in God when you don't have one? But that's all he would tell me, is trust in God. So he had me do this thing where he says, okay, put a rubber band around your wrist. Okay. He says, every hour on the hour, snap your wrist and say, thank you, God. I said, what? He said, yeah, do this. And until I tell you to stop, you know. So every day for weeks, I'm going, trust in God. Snapping this rubber band on my wrist. And it's a stupid little thing, but, you know, it works. I can tell you the first time that I actually prayed. Now, we do prayers in the meetings where we hold hands and say the serenity prayer, and we say our Father and stuff like that. You know, I could cheat on those. That's easy. But the first time that I actually prayed, I was still with that girlfriend, Joan, and I made sure she wasn't home. The doors were locked. The windows were, the lights were off, and it was nighttime, so nobody could see me, because I'm living in an apartment on the second floor, like somebody's actually going to pay attention to somebody like that. You know? So I said, okay, I got to get on my knees. So I got on my knees and said, okay. And I said some kind of prayer, and it wasn't to a God, because, again, I didn't have one of those yet. I hadn't done real work on the second and third step yet. I'd figured out that powerlessness over alcohol thing. That talks about in the first half of our first step. I hadn't figured out the second half of the first step. And in case you know, there's a hyphen in there. There's just two different thoughts up there. And it took me a long time to figure out that second half. It was a radio antenna with a red light on the top blinking about a half a mile away. And so I prayed to that for a while. Hey, you know, it won't keep me sober, but it was something. It took a while, many years actually, working through the second step and the third step to figure out something about God. And in our book, we have a chapter that talks a lot about spirituality. And there's a line in there that says, who am I to say that God does not exist? And I read that, and it's underlined in my book and highlighted all kinds of things. And it was a hard question for me to answer because I couldn't say, it wasn't up to me to say there was no God. It also says that God makes himself easy to find. He wants us to find him and have a relationship with him. Doesn't make it hard. The threshold is very easy to get over. And it only asked me, are you willing to now or ever believe in a God? And I said, well, yeah. And that really broke the ice for me. And I went, oh, it's that easy. It's that easy. You know, it was for me anyway. The rest of my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous from that point in time till now has really been trying to figure out that relationship between myself and God, as I call him now. You know, it tells me early in the book, very early in the book, that we have solved the drink problem. And that was true. Once I put the booze down and I start this journey, you know, the drink problem for today is solved. It's the rest of the problems that aren't solved. It's my character defects, fear, selfishness, dishonesty. Those aren't solved. Those take for the rest of my life to solve those problems. I don't have the compulsion to drink today. As I said earlier, you know, I don't know why I got to that treatment center on that particular Monday morning. And I also told you I didn't have a God and I didn't pray to God. I didn't ask anybody to take me there. It also tells me in the book that God does for me what I could not do for myself. It says that in a couple different places. And we read at the end of many meetings the promises, and it's one of the lines is there's God who's doing for me what I could not do for myself. And I've come to believe for myself, and it only is important for myself, is that this God that I didn't understand, didn't want in my life, and didn't believe in on that particular Monday morning said, okay, there's one poor, miserable SOB. I'm going to take pity on him and direct him into that treatment center and see what happens. Because it wasn't me. I can tell you that, not with a half a fifth of good scotch in the car, ready to drink that rest of that morning, and no place to go and nothing to do. He got me in there and kept me there for some period of time, enough to get a little physically well, not mentally well or anything like that, certainly not spiritually well. So that's what it was like. I mean, that's what got me in here. I was that drinker who in the mornings had to get to the nearest liquor store to get alcohol to maintain my physical being in the morning. And where I lived, there was several liquor stores within a driving distance, and I couldn't go to the same liquor store every morning. I mean, it would be terrible to know that the clerk in the liquor store saw me on Monday morning and Tuesday morning and Wednesday morning in a row buying a fifth of scotch every morning at 8 o'clock in the morning and going out in our parking lot trying to drink it. I mean, so I had to rotate all the liquor stores. And that's hard to manage when you're drunk and hungover and really in need of some alcohol in your system. Did I go there yesterday or did I go? Which one did I go there yesterday? Oh, my God, you know. Years later, somebody told me that I could have called a taxi cab and they would have gone to the liquor store and bought it for me. And I went, what? I didn't know this. You didn't tell me that. Oh, my God, you know, I could have saved myself so much grief, you know. Then I had to call different taxi cabs every day. So, I managing being a drunk is hard. It really takes some effort. We talk about service, too, and it was mentioned that, as Phil says, if you didn't show up, we wouldn't have a meeting here, and that's part of the service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a really, really an important part of of my sobriety. And when I was in treatment, I think I had my first service job, which they gave you chores to do in the treatment center. And one of the chores I first got was cleaning out the coffee pot. And, of course, in my overachieving way, I wanted to be the best coffee cleaner out person they ever had. And I did that for that stint for a week, and then he took it away from me. And I thought, how dare you? I mean, don't you see I had done this so well? And they gave me a trash detail. So, but don't you know who I am and everything? So, yeah. But service is really important. And sometime in my early sobriety, I became treasurer of Pickles and did that for a year. And then they had this rotation of service thing. And so they elected somebody else treasurer. And I thought, but don't you understand? I was such a good treasurer. Why are you electing somebody else? I don't understand this. But it's important to do that. And I've been fortunate enough to do some other service work. And part of my life was I got back in business, and I got an opportunity to move to the state of Utah to do some work out there for about 10 years. And I was gotten an AA. They used to have AA in Utah. And I got to be part of some interesting groups out there. And it's a much smaller Alcoholic Anonymous fellowship out there than it is around here. And where I was living, first of all, I could just walk to the meeting up in Park City. I could just literally walk from here like a half a block down to a meeting, which was really neat. For the first 2 years, it wasn't too bad. Then I moved out into the boondocks. And when I say out into the boondocks, it was for me to drive to the nearest meeting was 50 minutes away if there was no snow on the ground, and then 50 minutes back. And I would do that a couple times a week because there literally wasn't any meetings when you're, you know, 60 miles out in the country or 50 miles out in the country. The only thing out there are antelopes that go by your house or coyotes or something like that, and mountains and snow. So I got to do that for a while. The group I was going to, the GSR, could not go to area assemblies. But I could because I could travel easily. And the guy that became my sponsor out there was going to area assemblies, so he was dragging me along anyway. And I said, hey, I'm going there anyway. If, you know, I could be alternate GSR for the group, and then I'm going there anyway. And they went, oh, great. Okay, so you're alternate GSR. Well, the GSR, who was the lady who was the GSR, said, I resign. I went, whoa, wait. I said, I didn't think that was supposed to happen. She said, no, you do it now. So I did that. I did that for about 18 months, and then they said, well, we have another elections. And I said, okay, well, somebody needs to stand for GSR. Well, no, see, you didn't serve out a whole term. You only served out her term. So you have to do it again. I went, what? So I said, okay. So I did it for another 2 years. And at the end of that time, I said, you know, you guys got to elect another GSR, a general service representative for your group, because I've been doing it now for almost 4 years. Well, that's okay. You can do it again. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm changing jobs. I'm moving back to Florida. I'll be 2,000 miles away. You have to elect somebody now. Oh, okay. So anyway, but it's wonderful. I can tell you it's a lot of fun. And for those of you who are wondering about that service thing, do get into it. And we're really, really fortunate around here to have a lot of meetings to go to. And along the service line, we talk about promises that occur to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love sailing. It's been a passion of my life, my whole life. And in sobriety, I got to do a whole bunch of sailing. And since I had a lot of time on my hand, I signed up to be a what they call a delivery crew for new sailboats, where you go to the factory and pick up a sailboat, and they put a small crew on the sailboat, and they say, sail it down to the Caribbean for us. Well, sometimes it's fun. You know, you're on a small boat with three people, and you got to sail 1,800 miles to St. Thomas or something like that. Some of that can be interesting. Some of it can be fun. The neat part is they let you stay down there when you get down there for a while. But I did this one trip, and we ran into some really, really bad weather on the trip down. A little thing called Floyd, which kind of goes in our circle. But anyway, I get down to Virgin Gorda, which is the British Virgin Islands, and I had checked up on the fact that it was supposed to be an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting down there. I've been at sea for 16 days, and I thought, this would be a good time to go to a meeting. And so I go to this place that was listed as the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and it was up a little alley, and it's a small island, and there was kind of a sign on the door, but there wasn't anybody there. So I waited a little while. Some gentleman walked up, and he looked at me, and I kind of looked at him like, are you here for a meeting? I went, yeah. Okay, good. So he opened the door up, and we went in. And small room, tables, coffee pot, books, these things on the wall. And I knew where I was at. I knew it was an Alcoholics Anonymous room. And he opened the meeting up. We made coffee. We did the prayers. We did the readings. And we talked for an hour. And afterwards, it was three of us there. He said, I'm glad you came. I go, well, I'm glad you had the meeting here. He says, you're the first people who have walked in that door for the last 9 months. I said, what? He goes, yeah, nobody has come in the door for 9 months. I said, well, what do you do? He says, well, I come here Monday, Wednesday, and Friday nights, and I open the meeting up. And I set the coffee out, and I do the thing, and I read the introduction, and I read my book, and I do this for 9 months. And you're the first people who have ever come in the last 9 months. And I went, oh, really? You know? And it's not like he can go down the street, because this is on an island in the Caribbean, and you just can't. Because the next island is another country that you need a passport to get in and out of. He said, 9 months has been long. Other periods of time have been 6 months that nobody else has come in. And he said, you know, every 3 months or 4 months, somebody will wander in. We'll have a little meeting. 2 years later, I went down there and looked him up again. And we'd gone on a cruise. No, it was about 4 years later after that. We went on a cruise down there on a big ship this time instead of a 35-foot sailboat. And at that point in time, there was three groups alive on that island, and they had regular meetings, and people were attending every single meeting every single day. So, you know, driving 10 minutes or 15 minutes to your meeting to help open it up is not too much of a chore. When you compare it to this guy who did it for 9 months by himself, and he became kind of an AA legend down there because he basically started Alcoholics Anonymous on that island. And I thought when I was out in Utah driving 50 minutes to go to a meeting wasn't anything because he literally didn't have any other choices to do that. That was service, my best example of really going more than the extra mile to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what it really is all about. You know, when Bill got sober in the hospital and had his moment of spiritual release and standing on the top of a mountain and all that kind of stuff, that blinding light spiritual experience that Bill had, when he came home and talked to Lois about it, he wanted to not only carry the message to the next drunk, he wanted to carry it to the entire world. He was thinking of solving the problem for millions of people. I get out of treatment and I'm scared stiff just to drive down the road. So that's where it started, is that carrying the message. And while it's vitally important for me to stay sober each and every day and not put any alcohol in my system, because I know if I do, what'll happen, it's as equally vital that I do everything I can to help carry the message, because that is really part and parcel of what keeps me sober. From that person who didn't believe in God, didn't want a God in their life, or anything else like that, for after that point in time, in early sobriety, when I had done that work in steps 2 and 3 and had done work in 4 and 5 to look and find the character defects and started asked that God of my understanding to take those things away from me and done the other work that the program tells me I got to do. And I've had that spiritual awakening. It's not just a spiritual experience. It's actually an awakening that I know now that there's a God that cares for me as a human being in my life. I start each and every day asking, and I get on my knees and I ask my God to keep me sober today. And there's some other prayers I do that help me through that day. And then tonight, when I get ready to go to sleep, I'm going to get down on my knees and I say, thank you, God, for keeping me sober. Because I now know in my own heart that what happened on that August 27th was that God kept me alive and got me to the place where I needed to be. And there's a lot of other things and places that he's gotten me through through the years that are just, you know, how do you explain these things? How do you possibly explain some of these things? And I don't have to necessarily have to accept them and part of the faith of knowing that God works in my life. So I know it's coming to the end of the hour. Phil says I could talk as long as I wanted to, and so maybe I'll just stay around here. But yes, what he said. But I know there's also a cake over there, and it is getting 9 o'clock, so we're going to wrap this up. I do want to invite all of you to come over to Titusville, to the Primary Purpose Group on Thursday night. It has a big book study. It's one of the best big book study groups around. District 15 is also having a workshop February 26th in Titusville at the Yana Club on how to chair a meeting. And so if you have a group that experiences where people haven't been acting right in a meeting, or difference between an open meeting or a closed meeting, or how traditions work in a meeting, come to the district workshop on February 26th. It's going to be hosted by our North Florida area delegate, Cecilia R., who some of you may know in this room. She's up in Atlanta today at the Delegates Conference. And we're also having a conference agenda item workshop March the 12th in Cocoa. So we're having lots of service events over in Brevard County, and you all are all welcome to attend and help us carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, thank you very much for having me here tonight, and thank you, Phil, for asking me. I'll be able to return the favor at some point in time. Good evening.